Well, Abraham, one of the great patriarchs of the Bible, a man who spoke to God, a man who was called a friend of God, is responsible for the great blessings that most of us enjoy to this day, most of the Israelite nations. We all enjoy great bounty because of this man's role with God. You know, the Israelite tribes, maybe undeservedly today, have lived in peace, they have lived in prosperity. We have lived well above the means of many of the other countries in this world because of what Abraham did. But because of one of his great rebellious acts, many likewise in this world suffer greatly. Genesis 16, to start with. Genesis 16 is starting in verse 1. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children, and she had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. So Sarai said to Abram, "See now, the Lord has restrained me from bearing children. Please go unto my maid. Perhaps I shall obtain children by her." And Abram heeded the voice of Sarai. This is after they were told that they would become, that Abraham's seed would become a great nation. Then Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, and gave her to her husband Abram to be his wife, after Abram had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan. So he went into Hagar, and she conceived, and she saw that she conceived her mistress, became despised in her eyes. Then Sarai said to Abram, "My wrong be upon you. I gave my maid into your embrace, and when she saw that she conceived, I became despised in her eyes. The Lord judge between you and me." So Abram said to Sarai, "Indeed, your maid is in your hand. Do to her as you please." And when Sarai dealt harshly with her, she fled from her presence. Now the angel of the Lord found her by a spring of water in the wilderness, by the spring on the way to Shur. And he said, "Hagar, Sarai's maid, where have you come from? And where are you going?" She said, "I am fleeing from the presence of my mistress Sarai." The angel of the Lord said to her, "Return to your mistress and submit yourself under her hand." Then the angel of the Lord said to her, "I will multiply your descendants exceedingly, so that they shall not be counted for multitude." And the angel of the Lord said to her, "Behold, you are with child, and you shall bear a son, and call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has heard your affliction. He shall be a man or a wild man, and shall be against every man, and every man's hand against him, and he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren." Then she called the name of the Lord who spoke to her, "You are the God who sees." For she said, "Here I also see him who sees me." Therefore the well was called Beer Lahai Roi. Observe, it is between Kadesh and Bered. So Hagar bore Abram a son, and Abram named his son, whom Hagar bore, Ishmael. At this time he was 86 years old. You know, Abraham at this point rebelled against God. He decided to fulfill God's promise in his own way. Now, that wasn't rebellion, maybe like Satan. That wasn't a great rebellion, but it was going against what Abraham said he would do. He took it upon his own hands, his own mind of what, how he thought this promise should be kept. And it wasn't through Sarah. In Genesis 21, you can see some of the results of this rebellion. Genesis 21 and verse 1. And the Lord visited Sarah as he had said, and the Lord did for Sarah as he had spoken. For Sarah conceived and bore Abraham a son in his old age, at the set time of which God had spoken to him. It was God who set the time. It was under God's direction and under God's will that this took place, and when it took place. And Abraham called the name of his son who was born to him, whom Sarah bore to him, Isaac. Then Abraham circumcised his son Isaac when he was 8 days old, as God had commanded him. Now Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. And Sarah said, God has made me laugh, and all who hear will laugh with me. She also said, who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children? For I have borne him a son in his old age. And like I said, Abraham chose to fulfill God's promise on his terms and not God's terms. And that by and of itself is rebellion. It is going against the will of God. Even though it might seem right, even though it might seem the only plausible explanation for somebody that's in their 90s to conceive a child, in fact, God's will was done, and it was done through the woman that he wanted. It was done to be carried out through Sarah and Abraham's seed. In the summer of 1776, America severed ties with the British Empire. The Congress at that point issued the United States Declaration of Independence, rejecting the monarchy on behalf of the new sovereign nation, separate and external to the British Empire. You know, among the significant results of the revolution was the creation of a democratically elected representative government responsible to the will of the people. Well, as a country, we were wrong in declaring independence from England. Why? Well, why did we have to rebel against that nation? Why did we have to go about it in a big revolutionary war? Was it on our own terms that we did this, or was it through God's direct intervention? As we've seen throughout the Bible, God works on his own times. Anything that brings apart, you know, anything that brings apart the will of man, or man thinking that he can bring God's will out, sometimes ends in, while it might be directed and God might be allowing things, ends in ways with disastrous wars, much bloodshed because of our revolution. You know, a Catholic priest in 1517 started the Protestant movement by the name of Martin Luther. And he stated, I say then, neither pope nor bishop nor any man whatever has the right of making one syllable binding on a Christian man, unless it be done with a man's own consent. Whatever is done otherwise is done in the spirit of tyranny. I cry aloud on behalf of liberty and conscience, and I proclaim with confidence that no kind of law can with any justice be imposed on Christians, except so far as they themselves will. That's the key there. They themselves will, for we are free from all. You know, while the Catholic Church was wrong in what it had done, the abominations that it had brought upon this world through what they called Christianity, Luther was wrong also in his reasoning. We aren't free as Christians. We're bondservants. Anybody that has God's Spirit is a bondservant to him. We don't have free, in this reasoning, free will to do what we want to. We must submit to God's will. Well, you know, that same idea, the one of acting on our own terms, not on God's terms, came about long, long ago when Satan said, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will also sit on the mount of the congregation on the farthest sides of the north. I will descend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. And at its core, that is rebellion. It is putting our will above that of God. And rebellion has had its place in mankind's history, starting with the very first two humans. And it will not end until Satan is let go for that short time to test and to draw away more people after the millennial rule of Christ. You know, humans are born, we die, and all of us, except for one, has rebelled against God. So the question is, why is it so hard then to not rebel against God? Well, the short answer is it's because of Satan. He has so fundamentally influenced mankind's understanding of rebellion, just like pushing over a mound of an anthill. He has caused man utter confusion. We stumble over ourselves. We try to make do with what we can when there's no clear understanding of what is happening, when our foundation, when what keeps us together is torn apart. Sadly, the ease with which a child or a mean adult can knock over a anthill, red don't count because those sting, those are count. The ease at which somebody can do that is on par with how easy it is for Satan to confuse this world. The world is so deceived it doesn't know what it means to be in rebellion against God. The world thinks they are following after God, at least those that profess Christianity. The early founders of the United States that I mentioned fought against the tyranny of an oppressive government. They sought to set up a government free of the British monarchy, a government that gave their citizens inalienable rights, natural rights, also called inalienable rights, quoting a dictionary, are considered to be self-evident and universal. They are not contingent upon the laws, customs, or beliefs of any particular culture or government, and as we see, on any religion, on any belief of the will of God. The early founders of America were in direct rebellion to God when they set this government up. Now, that's a little bit of an overstatement, but there is a right and a wrong. And if we are not following exactly God's will, as Abraham didn't follow exactly that way, the consequences cascade down to what we have today, the descendants of Hagar and their involvement in this world. Our existence is based upon laws, upon beliefs, and most importantly, upon a government. That is key, but it's not our government. It's not a government that we decide we want. It's God's government. It's a government that He is setting up on earth and in His, for His kingdom. How the monarchy of England treated the colonies, how it treated, us as an early forming nation, was nothing but a reason for us to rebel. It wasn't an excuse. If you will, turn with me to 1 Samuel, chapter 8. 1 Samuel chapter 8, and starting in verse 1, we can see why. Getting a little deeper into this question. Now it came to pass, when Samuel was old, that he made his sons judges over Israel. The name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of his second, Abijah. And they were judges in Beersheba. But his sons did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain, took bribes, and perverted justice. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel in Ramah, and said to him, "Look, you are old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations." But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to judge us." So Samuel prayed to the Lord. And that's the key. Samuel went to God to get his will. And the Lord said to Samuel, "Heed the voice of the people and all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. According to all the works which they have done since the day that I brought them up out of Egypt, even to this day, with which they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also. Now therefore heed their voice. However, you shall solemnly forewarn them and show them the behavior of the king who will reign over them." So Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who asked him for a king. And he said, "This will be the behavior of the king who shall reign over you. He shall take your sons and appoint them for his own chariots, to be his own horsemen, to some to run before the chariots. He will appoint captains over his thousands and captains over his fifties. He will set some up to plow his ground, to reap his harvest, and some to make his weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers, cooks, and bakers. He will take the best of your fields, your vineyards, and your olive groves, and give them to his servants. He will take a tenth of your grain and your vintage, and he will give it to his officers and servants. And you will take your male servants and your female servants, your finest young men and your donkeys, and put them to his work. He will take a tenth of your sheep, and you will be his servants. And you will cry out in that day because your king, whom you have chosen for yourselves, and the Lord will not hear you in that day. Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel. And they said, no, but we will have a king over us, that they also may be like all of the nations, that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. And Samuel heard all the words of the people, and he repeated them in the hearing of the Lord. So the Lord said to Samuel, heed their voice and make them a king. And Samuel said to the men of Israel, every man go to his city. God warned Israel what would happen if they chose to live like this world and not like his people, not like God's people governed by the priesthood. And maybe a more poignant reason why the Declaration of Independence is in direct rebellion to God is because this country was part of the promise to Abraham. We didn't need God. We didn't need a revolution, or I should say God didn't need a revolution to make it so. God could have given us this nation in any way possible, and it didn't take us causing that revolution, that rebellion against maybe his will, to make it so. You know, the walls of Jericho didn't fall down because of the sonic bursts of the horns being blown that day. I've seen people talking and trying to figure out if those sonic waves could, in unison, blow down real walls. You know, the walls fell apart because of God's intervention, because of the people's reliance on God to lead them. You know, by relying on God, their paths were made easier to walk in. That city fell to them, and they did what they wanted to with it. It didn't take a long, drawn-out siege. They believed in God, and God made that city fall. You know, a war of independence was hard-fought, and while God's will was done, it wasn't easy. And it was a path that God could have led us down to achieve, if we'd relied on his will, if our forefathers had relied on his will, to achieve the same and probably even better results. You know, Martin Luther, as I mentioned earlier, while he was protesting against the corruption of the Catholic Church, by rebelling from that church, he was also rebelling from God. You know, it was good for him for standing up for an ultimately corrupt church at that time. You know, what brought about that corruption in the first place? 2 Corinthians 11. Starting in verse 1. Oh, that you would bear with me in a little folly. And indeed you do bear with me, for I am jealous for you with godly jealousy. For I have betrothed to you one husband, that I may present you as a chaste virgin to Christ. But I fear lest somehow, as a serpent deceived Eve by his craftiness, so your minds may be corrupted by the simplicity that is in Christ. For if he who comes preaches another Jesus, whom we have not preached, or if you receive a different spirit, which you have not received, or a different gospel, which you have not accepted, you may well put up with it. And that's the key. You might accept that heresy. Continuing in verse 12, but what I do, I also continue to do, that I may cut off the opportunity from those who desire an opportunity to be regarded just as we are in the things of which they boast. For such are false apostles, deceitful workers, transforming themselves into apostles of Christ. And no wonder, for Satan himself transforms himself into an angel of light. Therefore, it is no great thing if his ministers also transform themselves into ministers of righteousness, whose end will be according to their works. And the church had given itself over to a different spirit, that early apostolic church, after people got into it and changed it. What became the Catholic Church had no longer any truth in it. You know, while Luther strove to stand up against the corruption, it was done rebelliously. It was by his own hand, not necessarily relying on God. It's not to say that God didn't use those circumstances to move maybe even the Puritans, maybe even people to what started this country, but it was based upon Luther's teaching, and we know he was not a true minister of God. So how should we confront that evil? Jude 5. But I want to remind you, though you once knew this, that the Lord, having saved the people out of the land of Egypt, afterward destroyed those who did not believe. And the angels who did not keep their proper domain, but left their own abode, he has reserved in everlasting chains under darkness for the judgment of that great day. As Sodom and Gomorrah, and the cities around them, in a similar manner to these, having given themselves over to sexual immorality and gone after strange flesh, are set forth as an example, suffering the vengeance of eternal fire. Likewise also these dreamers defile the flesh, reject authority, and speak evil of dignitaries. Yet Michael, the archangel, in contending with the devil when he disputed about the body of Moses, dared not bring against him a reviling accusation. But he said, "The Lord rebuke you." That's kind of the key, that it's easy for mankind to go after their own way, to rebel in this way. But you look at one of the top three most powerful created beings to have lived, or to have been created, and he wouldn't. He never went again in on, you know, contended with the devil in his own will. He always had his foundation with God, to use his name, to not bring anything against even an archangel that he probably knew, he probably reasoned with. I'm sure those three powerful beings, when they were ruling on God's throne, would have communicated, would have talked, and the other two must have seen what was lurking within Lucifer. But with all of that, with knowing how Lucifer fell, how he became Satan, he would not bring against him accusations. He would not let his own perfect will, or perfect understanding of God's will, cloud that. You know, mankind's rebellion, and that includes God's people's rebellion, has, if you looked in verse 11, or as it says, you know, like Cain, we have gone the way of Cain. We have have been in much of this existence in utter rebellion against God. Rebellion is a strong word, but it's simply just it can be summed up as going against God's will. Anything that goes against God's will thus is rebellion to God. You know, God's people, the families of Israel, the families of Abraham's promise, have barely kept afloat in this worldwide sea of rebellion, this entire world that has rebelled against God. God's true church is not a grand billion-person group. It's a small thread of individuals that are keeping this plan, this will of God, alive. But, you know, it seems that God's own people have been in rebellion to him more than they have been in subjection to him. We can look at some of the old examples of this in Exodus 14. This ebb and flow of Israel and their relationship with God. Exodus 14, verse 10. And when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. Then they said to Moses, "Because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us out of Egypt? Is not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, 'Let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians'? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than we should die in the wilderness." And Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid, stand still, and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see again no more forever. The Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace." So after that, Israel believed and followed God, and there was no more rebellion. There was no more of Israel going after their own will, except for the next time they did it. Their entire story is this ebb and flow, as I said, going back and coming back to God and then going away towards rebellion. Numbers 21. Verse 4, "Then they journeyed from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to go around the land of Edom, and the soul of the people became very discouraged on the way. And the people spoke against God and against Moses, 'Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no food, no water, and our soul loathes in this worthless bread.' So the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, and many of the people there died." They had miraculous food being dropped upon them. They had miraculous events leading them out of Egypt, and they still could not concentrate. They could not rely on God's will. They constantly saw rebellion as their answer. You know, because mankind has rejected God wholeheartedly, God has hardened the hearts of mankind. It's not within our power to change that fact. It lies solely within God's power and will to harden people's hearts. Romans 9. Verse 14. "What shall we say then? Is there unrighteousness with God? Certainly not. For he says to Moses, 'I will have mercy on whomever I will have mercy, and I will have compassion on whomever I have compassion.' So then it is not of him who wills, nor of him who runs, but of God who shows mercy. For the scripture says to the Pharaoh, 'For this is the very purpose I have raised you up, that I may show my power in you, that my name may be declared in all the earth.' Therefore he has mercy on whom he wills, and whom he wills he hardens. You may say to me then, 'Why does he still find fault? For who has resisted his will?' But indeed, O man, you are to reply against, who are you to reply against God? Will the thing formed say to him who formed it, 'Why have you made me like this?'" And in verse 30, "What shall we say then? That Gentiles who did not pursue righteousness have attained to righteousness, even the righteousness of faith? But Israel, pursuing the law of righteousness, has not attained to the law of righteousness. Why? Because they did not seek it by faith, but as it were by the works of the law. For they stumbled at the stumbling stone." Israel sought after God in their own way. They rebelled against his clear teachings. They added to instead of listening to his simple commands and living by them. You know, if Israel is going to live in rebellion, if they were, God will harden their hearts. He did it again and again. And with or without their subjection to God, his plan will still carry forward. His plan always has, and it never will die. His plan, like the setting sun, will always take place, will always continue forward. Looking at mankind's rebellion, what do we... Let's look at maybe our own personal rebellion to God. You know, in all of history, there's never been a greater time than today to rebel against God. You know, think of it. The finish line is within our sights. We're almost at the end of this race. Now is the perfect time to rebel against God, as many of our brethren in decades past have. Now is the time to just throw that away and quit the race, to sit down and whine like that one Olympic racer did. Now is the time for us to get up and to not be pushed out of this lane. Brethren, we all have crowns laid up for each of us, guaranteed to us, if and only if we finish this race. 1 Corinthians 9. See what Paul said about this. First Corinthians 9 and 20. Got to 15. Notice there was no 29. Well, Paul spoke of that crown that was laid up before him as that final race that we cannot fail to finish. There is a crown. He knew there was a crown laid up for him, and there will be a crown laid up for us if we do not fall into the mindset of rebellion, fall into the mindset of our own will and not God's will. Let's try 2 Timothy verse 4, or chapter 4, excuse me. 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 6, to see his acknowledgement, understanding of what was truly laid up for him. For I am already being poured out as a drink offering, and the time of my departure is at hand. I have fought the good fight, I have finished the race, I have kept the faith. Finally, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give to me on that day, and not to me only, but also to all who have loved his appearing. There's much more depth of what it means to love God's appearing, to love Christ's appearing. But one key component of that is to not rebel against his words. You know, it's not a matter of somebody beating us to the finish line and taking one of those last three remaining crowns of only, you know, the 20 people racing. It's ours, but we have to finish the race. We can't give up. We can't rebel against God's will. And it's not just a matter of falling down over the finish line or crawling. Maybe it is a matter of crawling into it. It's not necessarily an easy race. It takes effort. It might be physically difficult. It might definitely be spiritually difficult. We must deny the flesh in order to finish this race. So why should we care about this world's rebellion? Should we just work on our own? Or should we be caring about what the bad path this world is taking as well? You know, is it just enough to worry about our own salvation? Maybe that of our family, our friends, our church? What should we be feeling about the world? What should our emphasis be for this world that is in rebellion against God? You know, do we hunger to see the destruction of this world, of these evil people? Maybe probably deserving of God's wrath, of his judgment. You know, natural disasters are impacting people all over the world, and many people love to see that, just to see the gore, see how people are suffering, but many people are really need of help, and they don't understand what that help can come from. You know, we are told to continuously be praying for the soon return of Christ, knowing full well that his return will bring judgment on a rebellious world. You know, it's easy to say no, to not desire the destruction of the world that rejects God. But what are we doing in our part, maybe, in relieving some of that impending pain? Are we trying to be lights to this world to the best of our degree to alleviate some of the pain that will come to a world that denies and that rebels against God? Maybe to look at some examples of people that, how they look to this world, what they try to do to do just that, to help kind of maybe alleviate and to be examples. To begin, let's turn to Jonah 1. a new Bible. That was a hard one to find. Jonah 1, and starting in verse 1. Now the word of the Lord came to Jonah, the son of Amittai, saying, "Arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and cry out against it, for their wickedness has come up before me." But Jonah rose to flee to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. He went down to Joppa and found a ship going to Tarshish. So he paid the fare and went down into it to go with them to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. But the Lord sent out a great wind on the sea, and there was a mighty tempest in the sea, so that the ship was about to be broken up. Skipping over to 8. Then they said to him, the people in that ship, "Please tell us, for whose cause is this trouble upon us? What is your occupation? Where do you come from? What is your country, and what people are of you?" And he said to them, "I am a Hebrew, and I fear the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land." Then the men were exceedingly afraid and said to him, "Why have you done this?" For the men knew that he fled from the presence of the Lord, because he had told them. Then they said to him, "What shall we do to you that the sea may be calm for us?" For the sea was growing more tempestuous. And skipping down to 15 in this story. So they picked up Jonah and threw him into the sea, and the sea ceased from its raging. Then the men feared the Lord exceedingly and offered a sacrifice to the Lord and took vows. Well, in one way, Jonah was a great example. Those people, he pointed them to God by his cowardly rebellion against God's will. Maybe in a way that he never thought of. That commission, God's word telling Jonah to go to Nineveh, was much like the commission given to us. We are to testify to a corrupt people, to a corrupt nation that has an impending judgment on them. And God can and God will deliver them if they repent. And we're not here just to tell people that they're going to die. We're here to tell people about the world to come. Maybe a way to escape this impending judgment. More importantly, that we are to tell them about the kingdom that will come. In Jonah 2, verse 10, "So the Lord spoke to the fish, and it vomited Jonah into the dry land." Chapter 3, "Now the word of the Lord came to Jonah the second time, saying, 'Arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and preach to it the message that I tell you.'" Just in case Jonah didn't hear the first time. "So Jonah rose and went to the Nineveh, according to the word of the Lord." Now Nineveh was an exceedingly great city, a three-day journey in extent. "And Jonah began to enter the city on the first day's walk. Then he cried out and said, 'Yet 40 days and Nineveh shall be overthrown.' So the people of Nineveh believed God, proclaimed a fast, and put on sackcloth from the greatest to the least of them. Then the word came to the king of Nineveh, and he arose from his throne, laid aside his robe, covered himself with sackcloth, and sat in ashes. And he caused it to be proclaimed and published throughout Nineveh by decree of the king and his nobles, saying, 'Let neither man nor beast, herd nor flock, taste anything. Do not let them eat or drink water. But let man and beast be covered with sackcloth and cry mightily to God. Yes, let everyone turn from his evil way and from the violence that is in his hands. Who can tell if God will turn and relent and turn away from his fierce anger so that we may not perish?' Then God saw their works, that they turned from their evil way, and God relented from the disaster that he had said he would bring upon them, and he did not do it." You know, what seemed like the impossible happened. That great heathen city came before God, repented. And of course, Jonah was ecstatic at God's will being done, of God's mercy being shown, of God's message being proclaimed. Well, maybe not completely ecstatic, maybe not at all. I don't know. It didn't seem. At that point, he was still in rebellion against God. He did what God said, didn't like what happened after that. It took God twice telling Jonah to go to Nineveh to preach to them. The first time he rebelled against God's commands. And yet God's will was done. Jonah 4, starting in verse 1. But it displeased Jonah exceedingly, and he became angry. So he prayed to the Lord and said, Ah, Lord, was not this what I said when I still was in my country? Therefore I fled previously to Tarshish, for I knew that you are a gracious and merciful God, slow to anger and abundant in loving kindness, one who relents from doing harm. And the key I wanted to look there is the first part of that chapter, or verse 2. Was this not what I said when I was still in my country? Jonah was still concentrating on his own will. He still had that rebellious attitude of, these people are evil. There is no reason that we need to save them. I'm going to do this because I have to, because a whale ate me and I was thrown upon their shores. But I don't like it, and these people don't deserve it. You know, the International Bible Encyclopedia said of Jonah, Jonah was a narrow-minded patriot who feared that Assyria would one day swallow up his own little nation. So he wished to do nothing that might lead to the preservation of that wicked Nineveh. Can we, whether or not that interpretation is correct of him, do we have that interpretation of the countries, maybe the evil countries in this world, that we really don't think deserve God's judgment or God's grace, that don't deserve God to change, to save them? That's a dangerous and a very rebellious attitude to get into. As this thing said, a narrow-minded patriot, patriotic attitude, one that does not look towards God's will, but one that looks towards one's own will. You know, Jonah was a reluctant prophet at times, it seems, at least when it came to preaching to those that he despised, who he thought might not be worthy of God's forgiveness. You know, do we take on that same outlook then, like I said before, as we preach to this rebellious world? And by preaching, that means living a godly example, being a light to those that are in darkness, being the light to those that need God's will, that need God's presence in their lives. Besides, who do we decide, or who are we, I guess, to decide whose message God should go to? Which societies, which nations this message should go to? Another example of I want to look at of a man, a couple of these maybe of better ways of following God's will, but Genesis 18 is starting in verse 16. Look at Abraham again. Genesis 18 and verse 16. Then the men rose from there and looked toward Sodom, and Abraham went with them to send them on their way. And the Lord said, Shall I hide from Abraham what I am doing? Since Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. For I have known him, in order that he might may command his children and his household after him, that they keep the way of the Lord, to do righteousness and justice, that the Lord may bring to Abraham what he has spoken to him. And the Lord said, Because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is very grave, I will go down now and see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry against it that has come up to me. And if not, I will know. Then the men turned away from there, and they went towards Sodom. But Abraham stood before the Lord. And Abraham came near and said, Would you also destroy the righteous with the wicked? Suppose there were 50 righteous within the city. Would you also destroy the place and not spare it for the 50 righteous that were in it? Far be it from you to do such a thing as this, to slay the righteous with the wicked, so that the righteous should not be as the wicked. Far be it from you, should not the judge of this earth do right? So the Lord said, If I find in Sodom 50 righteous within the city, then I will spare all the place for their sakes. That's the way to talk to God, to talk to the Melchizedek, or the the Christ. Abraham wasn't being rebellious. It's probably smart to be a little complimentary, too, about what God's role is. Abraham was not focusing on his own will, but he was talking God, which seems only if somebody called a friend of God could maybe be able to do that. He reasoned with the God of this world to save those unrighteous Sodomites. You know, Abraham showed, I guess the takeaway is the attitude that Abraham showed towards God. He interceded for those who very definitely didn't deserve it. And he was willing to push the envelope with the very God of creation to do so. And he did it, most importantly, he did it because of a relationship that he had already built with God. Another example of a man I wanted to look at, how they looked at this world, is Moses in Exodus 32. How they looked towards those who might not have deserved some ways. Exodus 32 and verse 7. And the Lord said to Moses, "Go, get down, for your people, whom you brought out of the land of Egypt, have corrupted themselves. They have turned aside quickly out of the way which I commanded them. They have made themselves a molded calf and worshipped it and sacrificed to it, and said, 'This is your God, O Israel, who brought you out of the land of Egypt.' And the Lord said to Moses, 'I have seen this people, and indeed it is a stiff-necked people. Now, therefore, let me alone, that my wrath may burn hot against them, and I may consume them, and I will make you a great nation.' Then Moses pleaded with the Lord his God and said, 'Lord, why does your wrath burn hot against your people, whom you have brought out from the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians speak and say, "He brought them out to harm them or kill them in the mountains and to consume them from the face of the earth? Turn from your fierce wrath and relent from this harm to your people. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, and your servants to whom you swore by your own self and said to them, "I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven and all this land that I have spoken of, I give to your descendants, and they shall inherit it forever." So the Lord relented from his harm, which he said he would do to his people. Again, Moses, like Abraham, had already built up a relationship with God. So that God, this is the key, so that God would hear him, much like God hears the prayers of the righteous. God can hear us, brethren. We have a direct line to God. We can intercede for those that don't deserve it, just like these great patriarchs. Moses was willing to plead with God to the point that God relented of his. And at this point, God said, "Get away from me. I am mad. I'm not happy with these people." And Moses stayed there with that being and reasoned with them to try to relent from what he was going to do. And after seeing what they did, Moses was willing to give up his eternal life in their place. That's why he was called such a humble man. So assuming that we have built up a relationship with God, that he actually hears us, you know, it's tough to kind of pick these two great examples, these great men that have walked on this planet, and say, "We'll just be like them and it'll all work out for us." But that's what God requires of us to strive to, if not to fully accomplish. You know, if warning the world from its soon coming judgment is an important concern for us, so that mankind turns from its rebellion, however unlikely that might be, and one of the necessary tools in doing that requires a relationship with God, and more importantly, a relationship with God so that he hears us, what are we doing to achieve that kind of friendship with God? But a couple of questions I wanted to look at that maybe we can ask ourselves in order to answer that question. First is, how are we confronting sin? Revelation 3 and verse 20. Revelation 3, verse 20. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come in to him and dine with him, and he with me. Then we have something knocking at the door. Christ knocking at the door. But that's not the only thing that once is knocking at the door. Sin also lies at our door. Kind of looking at a little bit of the, I know it's in Genesis 4 and 6 through 8. The Living Bible sums it as this. Sin is waiting to attack you, longing to destroy you, but you can conquer it. Cain didn't. He let sin enter when it knocked. It was the first, one of the first bigger, you know, the sin of murder of mankind. Eve, as we read in the Bible, was overwhelmed by deception and sinned. Adam was not to sin. He knowingly took that big bite. He relied on a human, not God's will, and he sinned. He tried to achieve that understanding in his own way, his own rebellion. But, you know, no matter how sin enters the door, the end results are the same. The reaction that we should have when sin knocks at the door should be the same as Joseph had. Genesis 39, verse 7. Genesis 39 and verse 7. And it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph, and she said, lie with me. But he refused and said to his master's wife, look, my master does not know what is with me in the house, and he has committed all that he has to my hand. There is no one greater in this house than I, nor has he kept back anything from me but you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? And that's a key that we always have to have with Joseph's action. This wasn't a sin against Joseph. This was a sin against God. God's will was the forefront of Joseph's mind. We know what he did. He ran from that sin. He resisted to that temptation to sin, resisted his own will being done, something that Adam and Eve didn't do when that temptation presented themselves to them. They didn't flee from it. You know, Joseph placed more importance on his relationship with God than the passing pleasures of this world. Another question is, what do we value? And do we seek our own happiness before trying to please God? If we do, the road we walk down is going to be lonely, and it's going to be without direction. Romans 8 and verse 5. Romans 8 and verse 5. For those who live according to the flesh set their minds on the things of the flesh, but those who live according to the Spirit, the things of the Spirit. For to be carnally minded is death, but to be spiritually minded is life and peace. Because the carnal mind is enmity against God, for it is not subject to the law of God, nor indeed can be. So then let those who are in the flesh cannot please God. But you are not of the flesh, but of the Spirit, if indeed the Spirit of God dwells in you. Now, if anyone does not have the Spirit of Christ, he is not his. You know, focusing on ourselves leaves no room for God, leaves no room for his will. It is, in fact, opposing God. It's because of his will that we exist. Pushing that will out of our desires is rebellion, is absence of God, and that will not achieve us that crown. You're knowing that we must give up our desires and focus on pleasing God, we're willing to remove ourselves from the comfort and find true safety through God. Not rely on physical comforts, maybe. Rely on true comforts and true safety. More so than Lot, even. And we know the story, what happened to Lot. And while the value of pleasing God was more forced upon Lot, you know, he was pulled out of that situation. he still was considered a righteous man. Sometimes it's difficult to leave those greener pastures and seek what really needs to be achieved, that will of God. Lot, when he was given the choice, wanted the green areas, and those also happened to be near Sodom. And he kept, started out in the path outside, and pretty soon he was in it. That same thing happens to us. If we forget God's will, if we listen to the values of this rebellious world, we soon will find ourselves living with it. Satan has made sure that the world is filled with pleasures that entice, pleasures that draw us to them and away from God. So what then, this one last question, what then are we willing to give up? And this is the key question that we must ask ourselves if we desire to please God. What are we willing to give up in order to please Him? We know what Lot gave up. He had to give up those green pastures, had to give up the city that he wanted to live in. We know Moses was mighty in deeds. He was a ruler in Egypt. He was in the throne of Egypt. He was probably schooled as the Pharaoh's son. But what was needed by God from him were 40 years of tending sheep. At that point, God knew that he was ready to lead the people. Abraham was shown the inheritance of his father, or he was shown not the inheritance of his father in Ur, of the Chaldeans, probably quite a wealthy man. He had a lot to give up. He left it with the faith that his true inheritance, what really valued to him, was going to be given to him by that being that he became a friend with, that he reasoned with later. And brethren, we must be willing to give up our own personal desires, our personal needs, our agendas, if we desire not to be in rebellion to God. When the self becomes our goal, we walk in direct opposition to God. Hebrews 3, verse 7. Hebrews 3 and starting in verse 7. Therefore, as the Holy Spirit says, today, if you will hear His voice, do not harden your hearts, as in the rebellion, as in the day of trial in the wilderness, where your fathers tested me, tried me, and saw my works 40 years. Therefore, I was angry with that generation and said, they always go astray in their hearts, and they have not known my ways. They swore I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. Verse 12, beware, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God. But exhort one another daily, while it is still called today, lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. We have become partakers of Christ if we hold the beginning of our confidence steadfast to the end. While it is said, today, if you will hear His voice, do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion. Again, that example of Israel, of their rebellious attitude, led to one thing. It led to a hardening of the heart where there wasn't an easy way to soften that heart again. A whole generation died out in the wilderness because of their rebellion and because of their hardening of the hearts. When we lose focus of God's will, we become rebellious. A rebellious attitude, like Israel before us, leads to a hardening of the heart, and eventually leads us to a state where we cannot be used by God's plan, where God will wait. He will let a generation die off. Is He doing the same for us today? Have we hardened our hearts in this world to the point that we are not ready for this marriage supper, that He's going to need another generation? I hope not, and I don't think not. I think there are still those with the soft hearts, those that have not rebelled, those that are seeking the will of God. But living by the exhortation in Hebrews to hold steadfast, to strengthen and encourage each other in order to keep another's hearts from evil, from not hardening, we can share in the promise that God is giving to each and every one of us today. One final scripture, if you turn me to Titus 2. If we keep these unhardened hearts, if we keep these hearts that are filled with God's will ahead of us, we have fantastic blessings, all because of the will of God. Titus 2 and verse 11. For the grace of God that brings salvation has appeared to all men, teaching us that, denying ungodliness and worldly lust, we should live soberly, righteously, and godly in this present age. This present age of evil, of people that maybe are undeserving of God's blessings. Looking for the blessed hope and glorious appearing of our great God and Savior Jesus Christ, who gave himself for us, that he might redeem us from every lawless deed and purify for himself his own special people, zealous for good works. Speak these things, exhort, and rebuke with all authority. Let no one despise you. Let no one get you, I would add, let no one bring you into a state of rebellion. Your brethren, Christ gave up everything. What we have to give up in this life cannot compare. Christ gave up everything. He focused on that fundamental key of giving up everything to serve the will of God. And he did it so that you and I would have a chance. Not that he would have a chance, that you and I would have a chance to know God, to fulfill God's will, that each and every one of us here today can share in that eternal reward and that eternal crown.